Well, this morning I thought this has nothing to do with the lesson. I just thought I'd share with you one of my favorite jokes, just because I thought it would be fun to do that. So there's these two brothers, and these two brothers are always in trouble, always in trouble. The mother is just beside herself. She has no idea how to straighten them up. She finally, out of sheer desperation, takes her two boys to the pastor down at the church. She goes outside, she says, goes into the pastor and says, I've lost it. I have no idea how to get to these boys. They're always in trouble. I'm just hoping you can have some influence in their life. And after you talk with them, send them home. And so the pastor decides he's going to talk to Bill first and leave John out in the foyer. So he brings Bill in, sits him down in the chair, and he decides he's going to get off to a really good start. He wants to just start at the very basics. So he just says to Bill, Bill, do you know where God is? And Bill doesn't say anything. Bill, this is a conversation. I need you to answer the question. Do you know where God is? And he keeps asking the question, and Bill refuses to respond. And the pastor continually gets frustrated. He gets frustrated more and more. And finally, out of desperation, he just slams his fist on the desk and says, I'm only going to ask you one more time. And you better give me an answer. Do you know where? And, well, Bill had had enough by that point. Bill was scared. He jumps up. He runs out, and he grabs Fred. I can't remember the name of the other. John. He grabs John. Yeah, that helps on the thing. You got to remember who the boys are. He grabs John, and they take off through the church. They're behind the organ. They're behind this pew. They find a back door. In the door they go. It's a ladder. Up the ladder they go. They're in the bell tower of the church, hiding behind a box, and they're just panting. And John turns to Bill and says, what happened in there? What are we running from? And Bill goes, God's lost, and they're blaming us for it. Like I said, it has nothing to do with the lesson today. Just happens to be. What's that? They should be on the back there. If you didn't, the copies are back there.
That's
so
a good start.
That's a good start. All right. If you have your Bibles, you want to turn. We're in chapter 12 of Revelation. And if we just put this in perspective, we've had the two witnesses. We've had this powerful testimony. And at the end of chapter 11, you have the sounding of the seventh trumpet. And then it goes right into this discussion. And we're basically, the next two chapters are going to really focus in on Satan and his activity during the Great Tribulation. And so we're going to look at that. And we might ask the question, well, why in the course of John's revelation, or why in the course of Christ's revelation to John and opening up the vision of what's coming, why would this fall now? Why would he put this in after the seventh trumpet? The general consensus is that there is some element of the judgment coming in the bowls, that this is to give a precursor to say this is why the bowl judgments are so severe. You get a chance to see the severity of it. The other thing, and I'll mention it, I state it later in your handout, but the other thing is we are going to see a transition from the judgment and God's anger and God's judgment to not only include mankind and earth, but it is going to include angelic beings and heaven. We're now going to see this become part of this revelation and part of the judgment. So, first off, you have the activity of Satan himself. Chapter 12 is going to focus on, and it's going to call him the dragon, but it's going to focus on his activity. This activity that we're going to see is not only kind of a review of what has occurred in the past, but also is relevant to what's going to go on in the Revelation during the Great Tribulation. And I'll show you kind of where that demarcation falls. But you have his activity. And these are the three things we'll look at today. This specific activity of Satan himself. Chapter 13, as we said, this is Satan's activity. Chapter 13 is going to focus on his agents, the beast. And it's going to describe who they are, and it's going to talk about where their power comes from in chapter 13, and it's going to lay that out. So the next two Sundays, today chapter 12, next Sunday chapter 13, we are really focusing in on Satan's activity during the Great Tribulation. And this is all a precursor to the bowl judgments that are about to come. And remember, I indicated to you that the judgments get more severe as they progress through the tribulation. So the seventh trumpet is actually, when it sounds, it declares, and it is the seven bowl judgments that are about to occur. Okay? So now we're going to look at verses 1 through 6. We're going to look at Satan, the dragon's hostility toward the child. So in chapter 12, if you look at it, verses 1 through 6 says the following. A great sign appeared in heaven, a woman clothed with the sun and the moon under her feet, and on her head a crown of 12 stars. And she was with child, and she cried out, being in labor, in pain, to give birth. And it says, then another sign appeared in heaven, and behold, a great dragon having seven heads and 10 horns, and on his heads were 7 diadems. And his tail swept away a third of the stars of heaven and threw them to the earth. And the dragon stood before the woman who was about to give birth, so that when she gave birth, she might devour her child. And she gave birth to a son, a male child, who is to rule the nations with a rod of iron. And her child was caught up to God and his throne. Then the woman fled into the wilderness, where she had a place prepared by God, so that there she would be nourished for 1,260 days. So we have three characters basically here. First off, you have the woman. But I wanted to draw your attention, I put up here for you, this idea of a great sign. A sign in Scripture is to give us a representation or to signify some truth, to give us some insight into that truth. I put up here, it describes something miraculous that points to some deeper spiritual significance. And so this woman is not a woman. She is a sign of something else. And so part of the interpretation is, who does she represent? Who does she signify? And you're going to have the dragon. And who does the dragon signify? And the child, and who does the child signify? So part of the interpretation is determining who these are. Now, within the Scripture context itself, if you're interpreting, you would take the things that are stated that you can specifically and knowingly connect to some other historical event to give you an insight. Okay? And so we're going to do that as we look at these. How do we identify who they are? I also want to let you know, in chapters 12 through 14, you're going to see a total of 7 signs that are going to occur. So this is kind of the sign section, a lot of signs, images that he's seeing that are representing something else to give us insight to a spiritual truth. Of these 7 signs, 3 are in heaven, 4 are on earth. 1 is good, only 1 of the signs are good. So 6 of them are signs of evil or judgments that God is going to lay out or pour out. Okay? So that kind of gives you the sign element. So as we look at this as a sign, the woman is representing something else. So the woman represents, we believe, and I think interpretive, we believe the woman represents Israel, the nation of Israel. So how do we conclude that? Well, when we look at Old Testament imagery, we have several connections that we can make. First off, this woman has a crown with 12 stars. And those 12 stars tend to represent leadership or individuals. And so automatically we're thinking the 12 tribes of Israel, okay? So the woman, 12 tribes of Israel. If you go into Genesis 37, you will have the vision of Joseph, who sees stars bowing down to him. And he identifies that imagery, he identifies as the sun being Jacob, the moon being Rachel, and the 12 stars being the 12 sons. So the Old Testament does this imagery, gives us an insight into who this woman would be. There's another element that you have in Old Testament imagery, and that is Israel in several prophecies and several Old Testament scriptures. She's referred to as a woman in wandering, a woman. And so I've placed that for you as well. And then we also know that this child that is coming, we connect that child to Christ coming through the nation of Israel from the sons of Israel. So, based on what we can see, the woman in this text that we have, the image, the sign of this is, we believe, to be Israel. And so this woman who's clothed with the sun and 12 stars is Israel. Some commentators would tell you that she, you know, as it says, she's in labor. She's ready to give birth. And many scholars would tell you that that's the image of pre-incarnate Christ when Israel is waiting for the Messiah to come. And so you have that imagery. And then we come to the image of the dragon, verses 3 and 4. And in this one, we have a specific declaration within the text later on that tells us who the dragon is. So if you were to jump ahead to 12:9, verse 9, He specifically says the dragon, who it represents. It's Satan, the devil. Okay? So in this case, the text itself, we're not having to just look at Old Testament imagery. We're looking at the initial context tells us exactly who the dragon is. So now we know in the context of this passage, whenever it refers to the dragon, his actions, we can connect those to Satan's actions and what he's done. In this, he gives you the image prior to Christ's coming that he is in wait for the child to be born and he wants to devour the child. We recognize that. If you recall, Satan attempted, once the child was born, Christ. He tried to thwart his ministry through the temptations in the wilderness. He tried to basically not allow God's plan to come to fruition by destroying the Messiah. Okay? And so you have him in wait. Now, it does give us another image here, which is interesting, because as he's looking at this dragon, he sees 10 heads on the dragon, and he sees 7 horns.
7 heads.
7 heads and 10 horns. It is generally understood that this is a picture of rulers and nations. And somehow there's going to be 7 nations that he is controlling, and there's going to be 10 rulers. And I'll just give you a spoiler alert. Later on, it's going to define that one of those horns becomes the beast that comes to power. And then we're going to see that in a later text. But they recognize this as being the 10 horns, being 10 kings. I've given you also from Revelation 17, it points to that as well. And then the 7 diadems, we have a connection to other Old Testament prophecies in the end times from Daniel about these 7 nations, 7 diadems. Okay? So just like the woman, when she was looked at, she had a crown with 12 stars that signified rulers and other individuals. You have Satan, the dragon, also has this imagery of rulers, heads, and nations. Okay?
Well,
yeah.
Time frame, that red area that you...
Yep.
Okay. Where does that appear in this? So all these people... Oh, this thing is going to come in the last section of, what is it, 3 months, 4 months?
3.5, well, there's 3.5 years. We're not, yeah.
What about that time?
The nations and everything, the understanding is that these are a depiction of the powers that will come to be during the 7-year tribulation.
Okay.
And there's going to be these nations that are controlled by Satan and these kings. And one of those kings, the beast, is going to come to power and rule over all of them, and there's going to be this sense of...
During
the 7-year period, yes.
Okay.
And during the 3.5, which is called the Great Tribulation, we recognize that at that point, the beast, the one that comes to power, and we're going to get other details about him, he actually comes to full power in that 3.5-year period, and these other kings and everything will come under his rulership. Okay? And then he points to a fact of 1/3 of the stars represent the angels led in rebellion against God. It talks about his tail, and it sweeps 1/3 of the stars, and we have reference in the Old Testament of the rebellion that Satan, Lucifer, does to God, and in that process, angels follow him, and those angels then are judged with him, and that sweeping of those angels and all is believed to be that third of the angelic host that align themselves with Lucifer. Okay? All right, so we've kind of got that. So that's the dragon. He's in wait. He wants to thwart God's plan. Chad?
Is it your understanding that the dragon sweeping the angels is occurring at this time period? Because I've seen reference to this sort of being when Satan fell the first time. It's sort of jumping back to that.
There are 2 references you have in the initial fall of Satan in heaven. There's 1/3 of the angelic host that are judged. You have later on, we're going to see in the text, that 1/3 of the host and Satan are thrown to the earth. Some refer to this thinking it's just a precursor to what's coming where they're thrown to earth. Others connect it to the connection, but it basically is giving us that context that the dragon has 1/3 of the angelic host following him, and they are under judgment. Okay? So now we come, the child. We have the male child, which occurs in verse 5. And the initial, this one starts out as a review because we know if it's Israel, we know Satan's interest in destroying this one child. You also have the descriptors of this child as being that he was born in the nation of Israel, he's going to be rulers of nation, and he's caught up into heaven. So we're looking at the first advent of Christ, the birth of Christ in the nation of Israel, and he's caught up into heaven. Satan's opposition to Christ is shown that Christ is victorious and he's in heaven, but then he shows us he has a continued antagonism toward the nation of Israel. Even though he could not defeat Christ, he did not quit. He still has an antagonistic view of Israel. Now, I would draw a line for you pretty much in the text where it says he was caught up to God and to his throne in verse 5. And that, to me, is a review. That's reviewing. We recognize there's a historical event that we can attach to that. We recognize from the scriptures that there was an event when the child was born, when the child lived, when he sacrificed, when he was victorious, and then when he left on Mount Olive to go sit at the right hand of the Father, and he's coming again. And then I think what you have in verse 6 is now it's coming into this great tribulation period, because it now refers to the woman fleeing. And it gives us this context. In my interpretation, the fact that he brings up the 1260 days again is identifying that period in the Great Tribulation. We've seen that in chapter 10. We've seen that in chapter 11. The 42 months, the 1260 days, the time, times, and half a time, and that Great Tribulation period. So I think as he's sharing this vision, he gives us these contextual components that we can link to the previous statements. And that 1260 days or the 42 months, we've recognized as the Great Tribulation. And so when he talks about the woman fleeing and being nourished for 1260 days, I think it's appropriate to say, okay, he's now coming to the vision now where Israel is in the Great Tribulation. And these are faithful, believing Jews who have come to believe in Christ and obey the scriptures. And they are the ones that now God is going to be nourishing during that time frame. And Satan's antagonistic approach is going to heighten against them during that time frame.
Is that the 144,000?
No, I believe the 144,000 is a part of that, but the group is larger than that. Okay. That's my interpretation.
All right. Five.
Yes.
She gave birth to a male child.
Yes.
Christ, right?
Yes. Yes. Yes, we believe that.
In my language.
Yeah.
Okay. One who is a ruler of all the nations, so I can understand that one. But this one I don't understand. When he rules with an iron rod.
You don't got that. Okay, an iron rod. We would use vernacular if somebody is going to be a judge, and going to punish. His rule, if it's a judgment rule, we would say he's judging with an iron rod. He's punishing you correctly for what you've done. It's a sense that he has the power to rule, the power to punish. It's an image. The iron rod. It's the idea of looking at a king standing on his throne, and he has an iron rod in which to carry out justice. It's a signal signifies his power, his authority and his power.
There's a verse in Isaiah or Psalms about Jesus ruling with a rod of iron. I'm trying to remember where it is, but...
Yeah,
I took that as an allusion.
It is. The Old Testament imagery that we have will all in Lincoln it, and you're absolutely right. So it has a prophecy. What is referring to, I think that's what you were asking, what does that iron rod refer to? It's a symbol of his power and his justice.
I show it as Psalm 2:9.
Psalm 2:9. Thank you. He will rule with an iron rod. Okay, so the woman is going to be cared for during these 1260 days. God is going to provide that. I just wanted to tell you, in the Old Testament imagery, the wilderness has different connotations. It can be a place of desolation. It can be a place of safety. It can be a place of discipline or a place of testing. You have Christ going into the wilderness to be tested. You have those wandering in the wilderness as discipline. The Israelite nation, they wandered in the wilderness as a disciplinary act for their lack of faith. So the wilderness concept here, when you put it in context, is the idea of safety. They're going to go outside the city of Jerusalem. They will flee and head outside the city of Jerusalem for safety. And there's going to be a miraculous, God-intended protection. And not only that, but nourishing, meaning he's going to provide for them. We have another context that the Israelites would have recognized in the 40-year wilderness wanderings. You have a clear indication in that event that Christ or that God provided their needs. He provided them quail, he provided them mammon, he provided them water. He nourished them in the wilderness where they should have died, but he nourished and took care of them. And that's the imagery that you kind of have here, okay? And it refers to the angels in being participants in this as well. Okay? So this imagery in the you have through verse 6 is Satan's activity as he is attempting to be hostile toward the child. And when the child is then taken to heaven, his hostility then turns toward the nation of Israel. Now he changes the scene. And by the way, this reference to heaven is, sometimes it can mean the sky or it can actually be the heavenly place. This is a reference to actually something that's going on in heaven, the abode of angels and where God is. And what you have is, in 7:9, let's look at that. It says, and there was a war in heaven, Michael and his angels waging war with the dragon and his angels waged war. And they were not strong enough, and there was no longer a place found for them in heaven. And the great dragon was thrown down, the serpent of old, who is called the devil and Satan, who deceives the whole world. He was thrown down to the earth, and his angels were thrown down with him. Then I heard a loud voice in heaven saying, now the salvation and the power and the kingdom of our God and the authority of his Christ have come. For the accuser of our brethren has been thrown down, and he who accuses them before God day and night. And they overcame him because of the blood of the Lamb and because of the word of their testimony. And they did not love their life even when faced with death. For this reason, rejoice, O heavens, and you who dwell in them. Woe to the earth and the sea, because the devil has come down to you, having great wrath, knowing that he has only a short time. So you have this picture of an event occurring in heaven. And it is apparent that it's like a battle that Satan is now attempting to control. He's again attempting to take control in heaven, and you have a war with Michael, Michael the archangel. We recognize Michael as the leader of God's angelic host. We've seen it in other texts in the Old Testament. You have the dragon, the leader of the fallen angels, and this conflict is just before the Great Tribulation because of the 1260 days. So that point is where we're looking at Satan being cast out of heaven. Draw your attention to the following. Cast out of heaven. The question is, what is significant about that? Well, it gives us a connection that Satan currently, evidently, has the ability to enter the throne room of God and accuse brethren. He is not locked out of heaven yet. He is day and night in the presence of the Father accusing us, saying that we are not worthy of his grace, not worthy of his mercy. Okay?
Rob, you know what? I have never thought that Satan is up there. It's a revelation. Unbelievable. I know for all these years, 80 years, I've been thinking God's up. I mean, he's up. He's down here. He's up there. But you're saying now that
it's like
together.
Job.
Job is one of the references where Satan is allowed to go before God and ask God to test Job. And if you read that text, it's like he's the accuser. Oh, he's only happy because you're good to him. If you're bad to him or allow him to suffer, he's going to deny you. And it says in the text, God allowed Satan to remove the good. Satan doesn't have control, but he gets permission. For whatever purpose God had, God saw that as his plan. He wanted it and he allowed it. But Satan could not do it without God's permission. So we recognize, based on this text, that Satan is currently day, and it says in here, day and night accusing. The other context you have later on, you'll see day and night he's in the act of deceiving us. He's the great deceiver and the great accuser. What's that?
He's such a liar.
Yes.
With us as believers.
Yes.
Concentrating on
so what we recognize in this text, this war goes on, and again, it says Satan and his angelic hosts that are with him are not strong enough, and therefore they are cast out of heaven. They are literally cast out of heaven to the earth. Okay? They are thrown down. Satan no longer has access, and I believe that's why you have this joyous declaration. As soon as he's cast out of heaven, what do they say? The salvation and the power of the kingdom of God and the authority of Christ has come. The deceiver no longer has access to heaven. I mean, it's almost like if you're watching a game and the final victory, the last minute, the 3-second shot, it hits. What does the entire stand erupt in? Yay! I mean, that's kind of the image you have is, finally, you kicked him out. Finally, you said no more. You can't come in here anymore. And you just have this. And remember that earlier in the text, you have the martyrs under the altar. And what are they crying out? How long? How long until? And this is the point. Boom, no more. And he's removed from heaven. And so you have this expulsion from heaven in verses 7 through 12. And basically his removal from heaven is great for heaven, not going to be that good for earth. Okay? He's thrown down. Any questions or comments on that? Yes?
If Satan was still in heaven, casting dispersions upon people, were the people underneath the throne... where we talked about them earlier.
Yes.
Are they there because Satan still had power to harm them?
No. I don't think so. I don't think he had any power to harm them because they were in heaven clothed in white, which was the indication of the garments that they would receive.
Yeah.
And so I think they were just crying out, how long on earth will you allow this to continue?
We just said he's in heaven.
Well, he has access to heaven. He has the ability to go to heaven and be an accuser. So the access is there. I would like and put it this way, that heaven is not his abode nor his home, but it is a place he has access to. And evidently he and his angels still had access in that realm, that area. But they were still under judgment. Think of it this way. If Satan and the angels no longer had access to heaven, there would be no war. They would have no ability to fight. And yet here they are in war with Michael and his archangels. So somehow in that realm, they still have access. And there is this battle, this war that takes place. And they are cast out for good.
Rob, who are they? Who would he be accusing?
Us.
After we're already raptured?
No. I believe his accusations and accusing is of those who are on earth who are the faithful ones.
Yeah.
And he's accusing and he's deceiving. That act. Once you have passed away, once you are in the presence of God, that is an eternal location, and every reference we have is that the sadness is gone, the tears are gone, the pain is gone, the weeping is gone, which would give us clear indication that we are no longer
under Satan's power,
or the ability for Satan to impact us. If he did, we would say we're saved, but we're still going to have sadness until he finally... I mean, that's the imagery I have. So this deceiving... put it this way. When you pass away and you go in the presence of God, Satan has lost you. He has no more opportunities. There are none left for him to deceive you. There is none left for him to accuse you because the blood has been applied. And in heaven, theologically, the blood has already been applied to those who believe, but yet Satan is still actively attempting to deceive the believer, as well as deceive the non-believer, trying to hold them away from a position of faith with God.
And we still have to put up with him from time to time when we're in heaven. We still have to put up with him.
In heaven?
Yeah.
No, I don't believe we will be putting up with him.
Today and go to heaven.
Yes.
We still have to put up with him periodically.
No.
I guess he'll be in hot, which is saying he'll have access to heaven. So he's, we might pass each other in the hallway, so to speak.
I think we probably would want to keep from taking earthly recognition of access and everything and putting those same characteristics in heaven. What I mean by that, it's I don't know that we would pass him in the hallway or have a conversation with him or whatever. I believe there's a separation in that, but Satan still has the ability to approach God and accuse. But that accusation ends once you are... Once the redemption of your life is complete, meaning the physical body has died and you now are in the presence of God.
That's what
you assume, and I think you're correct in that assumption. Scripture would hold you to that.
Rob, I was thinking about an analogy with foreign ambassadors having access to the Oval Office to go meet with the president. Well, they can come and they can say things, but they have no power within the
right.
United States. They would have power over Americans who are in Red
that's
China.
That's a good illustration,
for example.
Yeah.
And when the Americans leave Red China and get back here, then they're safe.
Yeah.
So I was thinking about it in that context. So Satan must have the ability to approach the throne of God and tell his lies and say, you know, Mark's doing bad again. See, he's at work.
He's at work right now.
What's interesting to me is I know what's coming is we just look at what's going on earth and we don't connect it to the conflict in heaven. Mm. So the conflict in heaven must kind of ripple out down here on earth,
yeah,
where we see things. But it sort of tells us, it's kind of like in Daniel and the archangel was held up by you know, certain demons as he was trying to get to Daniel and answer prayer. So there's conflict in heaven, but it shows up to our vision down here.
Yeah.
And Satan is aware that his time is limited. I mean, that's what's so crazy
that's
about
what
this.
Is.
Yeah.
Does Satan know how this is going to end?
He's got to. He has the
Bible. He does.
If we look at scriptures about demons, just as angelic host, we have a recognition that they knew who Christ was, without a doubt. They knew his power, they knew who he was, and they knew they were under his authority. So just like we look at man on earth during the tribulation, these things happen, and scriptures tell us they look at it and declare, this is God, but then what does it say? They continue
to
turn away and not respond in faith. In the angel process, just as a background, when the angels were created beings just like humans, there was a revolt that Lucifer led based on pride. He wanted to be like God. Same thing that Adam was tempted when Satan said, eat the fruit and you'll be like God. God doesn't have the best interest in mind for you. He's holding the good from you. That whole deception. And so the angels were judged, and that judgment is done. It's done. There are no angels that are changing from one side or the other. That judgment is finished. But their eternal punishment has not been realized. And so they have been allowed to continue to operate, if you will, in opposition to God. Satan becomes a deceiver, trying to thwart his purposes, and they are still allowed to operate. And you're starting to, as I said, you're starting to see the judgment that God has is now starting to show it's going to include Satan and the angelic host. Not just mankind on earth. It's now going to be Satan and the angelic host. He is going, like prophesied in Genesis, he is going to be defeated completely.
Does he just want to take as many people with him?
That's all we can figure out in this sense.
Exactly. Because after he's hurled to the earth from heaven, he is not able to go back.
No.
So that, to me, that's...
And yes, and what you're going to find is, this will be a spoiler alert, if you will. At the end of the tribulation, Satan will be bound and put in the abyss for 1,000 years. But it tells us he's going to be released for one last revolt at the end of the millennial period. And we'll look at that in the text. It really is amazing that you look at a being that that was created by God, knows who God is, knows his power, is continually being defeated, cannot win, at least in the understanding, and yet continues to fight a losing battle.
There's no concept of forgiveness for the fallen angels, though, is there?
No.
So they really have no other choice.
No. No, they, based on what we understand from Scripture, that decision was made when they sided. Their decision was to side with Lucifer or side with God. Those who sided with Lucifer, we call them demons, the fallen angels.
I mean, that explains it partially, that they're acting out of rage.
Yeah,
They have no other option.
Well, yeah, and you're going to find that as we look a little farther in this text. What does Satan do now that he can't go to the throne anymore? He heightens his attacks. Okay?
Will those angels be cast in the lake of fire?
Yes. Okay. So now what we have, his vengeance, which is an appropriate term. You have this trying to destroy the child. He's defeated in that regard. Now you have this warfare that occurs in heaven. He's cast to the earth, no longer has access. And what does he do? He becomes very vengeful. Okay? So look at verse 13. And when the dragon saw that he was thrown down to earth, he persecuted the woman who gave birth to the male child. But the two wings of the great eagle were given to the woman so that she could fly into the wilderness to her place where she was nourished for time. Again, here you've got that time frame. Time, times, and half a time. From the presence of the serpent. And the serpent poured water like a river out of his mouth after the woman so that he might cause her to be swept away with the flood. But the earth helped the woman, and the earth opened its mouth and drank up the river which the dragon poured out of his mouth. So the dragon was enraged with the woman and went off to make war with the rest of her children who keep the commandments of God and who hold to the testimony of Jesus. If you just look at this, you have somebody who is so angry. I mean, the picture is Satan is so angry, he's kicked out of heaven, and it's almost like, okay, you do that to me, I'm going to go after those who belong to you. And I'm not just going to go after them, I'm going to go after them with force. And then in the text, he tries to destroy them, and yet they are miraculously protected. And again, he's defeated. So what does he do? Well, if I can't get you, I'm going to go after everybody else that's connected to you. So you have this image of his vengeance. He's doing everything he can, in my mind, in a last-ditch effort to cause as much damage as he possibly can. Okay? Yes?
There is, I've heard of a theory, another possibility for his actions is one of the conditions for Jesus Christ's return is that the Jews have to acknowledge their offense as a nation. They have to say, yes, we sinned against you, and ask him to come back. Jesus said, I will go until they acknowledge their offense and then I'll return. Well, they can't acknowledge their offense if there's no one left. So there's the thought that Satan's trying to once again thwart the plan by wiping out all the Jews so no one can ask Jesus to come back and therefore he cannot return.
Okay. That's
theory of.
The imagery you have in verse 13 is where he has this concentrated vengeance. And I tend to think something occurs during that 3.5-year period where the faithful Jews flee Jerusalem. They flee Jerusalem and head to the wilderness because they are under persecution at such a heavy level, they are just fleeing for safety. And his vengeance is, as they're fleeing, he attempts in some way to destroy the entire, the Jewish faithful that are fleeing the city of Jerusalem. And in that process, we have the fact that this is some element. And the imagery, I tend to think it's possibly a metaphor, the flood. It could be a literal flood, but I think it's more a metaphor when you talk about a flood of an army. And oftentimes, a flood can be overwhelming evil. The army came on us like a flood or like a tidal wave or something. And so I think this may be an imagery piece, just an image of how this massive force is coming after them, and somehow the earth swallows it up. When Israel left Egypt and they crossed the Red Sea, the waters parted so they could get across, and then the earth, by God's command, destroyed the army. In my mind, I'm thinking this could be some similar act on earth where there is something going after them, like they did out of Egypt, and somehow the earth swallows it up and destroys that army or whatever it is that Satan sends after him. But his vengeance is intense, and he's wanting to destroy the children of the woman, which is the Jews. Yes? Oh, I thought I saw a hand. It refers to a couple things here. Draw your attention to. Talks about the wings of an eagle. This is a common image out of the Old Testament. I give you a couple references here in Exodus 19. I lifted you on eagle's wings. That's when God delivered the nation of Israel. Deuteronomy 32, the Lord spread out his wings to protect them. You have also in Isaiah 40:31, which is often quoted by believers, where you're as if you will rise up as if you have wings like eagles. And so that imagery is a common image for us. And that is a depiction of his divine assistance. He's going to protect them. He's going to take care of them. He's going to deliver them. He's going to nourish them again. And I draw your attention back to what we recognize when the nation of Israel was wandering in the wilderness. God miraculously nourished them and protected them. And then the last thing you have is that he now concentrates his vengeance on the non-fleeing Jews. Those who didn't flee, those who remain, they're faithful, they're recognized as obeying God and understanding who Christ is. So these are believing Jews who remained in the city, and now he concentrates his evil intent and his vengeance on them. Okay? The last thing, and then we'll just open it for your comments. Three things I want to draw your attention to in this text. This is a quote out of one of the commentaries that I wanted to give you, because if we just understand from Genesis to Revelation, Satan's intent, all satanic activities are carried on under the double motive of ambition to rule and be worshipped and hatred toward the one whom God has chosen to take the kingdom Satan has usurped. So Satan either wants to rule or be worshipped or destroy Christ, who is taking the kingdom that he's usurped. As I stated earlier, this chapter you should recognize that the judgment picture now extends to heaven and angelic beings. So we're getting this as a complete and Revelation is showing us it's a complete and final judgment of all that he has created. And then you have at the end, this includes God's final victory over the dragon, the great deceiver. He's removed from heaven. And then the martyr's victory is referred to later on, where it talks about that they have defeated the dragon by the blood of the Lamb and the word of their testimony. Okay? So that if we look at this, we get insight into Satan's activities. We get insight into God's judgment of Satan. And we can look forward to him being cast out of heaven, the great deceiver cast out. But there will be a time in which his vengeance will be allowed to be poured out. Not only God's wrath, but Satan's vengeance. God's wrath on the unbelieving, Satan's vengeance on the believing. And it will be at a highly intense full period of time toward the end of the Great Tribulation.
Well, toward the end of the tribulation, there's the big war.
Big war. Armageddon.
And yet at the end of the millennium, there's going to be another uprising.
Yes.
So when you say God's final victory, which victory are you talking about?
Good point. I'm referring to the victory here as pointing to the fact that the deceiver is removed from heaven, and the martyrs have been victorious.
Okay.
Good point. Probably should not have used, I appreciate the editing. This is the first final victory. Okay. No, I don't know.
That's a city battle.
What's that?
That's a city battle.
Yes. And that's a good point. I'm glad you brought that up, because it is a sense that there are still some other actions that are going to take place and still some other judgments. So let's focus on that victory being his removal from the presence. That was the intent, his removal from the actual presence. The deceiver no longer has access to deceive.
Well, I got that from you. I was listening
yes,
to what you said earlier.
I appreciate the clarification.
I didn't come in here with the...
No, I truly appreciate the clarification. I truly do. Yes?
Rob, I was thinking about the first bullet point there, Satan's motives, and the third temptation of Christ by Satan, where he says, I'll show you all the kingdoms of the earth, or all the cities of the earth, and I'll give all that to you if you'll bow down and worship.
The worship, yep.
So he's saying, I've got authority over the earth, and you know, I'll give this to you if you'll subject yourself to me.
Yeah.
You'll put yourself under me by bowing yep. down and worshiping me.
Yep.
So he sought to subjugate Christ
yep.
through that.
Yeah, I thought that quote was pretty good, because if you look at Satan's activities, it kind of fits into those motives. To rule and be worshiped, or to destroy the one who is actually going to rule the kingdom that I took away, that I attempt to rule. Good.
It just shows you how bold Satan is to go and tempt Christ. That he is his creator.
Yeah.
He knows that.
He never gives up.
So.
Never gives up.
That's what I mean. He's bold. He's not going to give up.
I think we can clearly understand that there's a recognition that Satan and demons know that they will not win. I mean, there's got to be a recognition of that. But it has not changed their passion and desire to either destroy what God has made or draw others into their sin. We can recognize that. I've teaching high school for a long time, and kids, I've often found kids who find comfort in getting somebody to join them in their sin, because somehow that tends to justify or validate that my sin is okay if I'm not alone. Or I get people around me that will tell me the wrong that I'm doing will tell me it's right, and I will somehow find some, it doesn't give you true peace, but it somehow kind of maybe dulls the
trying to justify it,
somehow feel like it's okay. Yes?
There's a scripture somewhere, and I don't remember where, but it is a reference to Satan being on earth, roaming the earth, like, seeking whom he may devour.
It's in James, yeah. He roams to seek whom he may devour, yeah. So roaring lion. I think it's James. That's what came to my mind. Is it 1 Peter? Thank you. 1 Peter, I was off by a few books.
Yeah.